for the data before you look around you. And then mostly I talked about two problems. So this is from talk one, the moduli problem. And a slight variant of the moduli problem, the decompactification problem. The former problem, recall, is that typical string compactifications have a very large number of light fields with gravitational strength couplings. And such fields store energy during inflation, and they typically don't decay by the present day. And so they can cause a lot of cosmological problems. The second problem, the decompactification problem, is that positive energy drives decompactification. Which was the origin of these various pictures, where here rho is a volume modulus, and here's the potential for rho. The reason I was drawing a lot of polynomially following potentials with their minima at infinity, infinite volume, which is 10B flat space. Okay? And this is a statement that I proved to you for an anti-D3 brain, but I was arguing is true for most sources of energy that you could find in string theory. Okay, and then in the last part of the first lecture, I explained the KKT proposal, which is a scenario for overcoming these two problems using techniques of flux compactifications. So what I want to do today is, first, a quick recap of KKLT. Not enough to bore you, I hope, but enough to refresh your memory on what exactly all the ingredients are that were needed for that proposal. Two, I want to talk about D-brain inflations, which is one of the popular approaches to realizing inflation in string theory. I'll give you some comments about the other approaches. Now, perhaps most importantly for today, the thing I really hope that I will be able to communicate to you is, what is the eta problem and why is it a real burden for string inflation model building? Okay. So I'll come to that when what the problem is. And four, I want to explain why observable tensor modes are possible only for implotons that range over Fickian distances. I'll make those statements precise. So before I start, any questions about the material I covered last time? Okay, so the recap of KKLT. Consider a type 2B string theory on a collabial. Technically an orientable of a collabial, but we're not going to be worried about that. And from the closed string sector, i.e. not considering any D-brains yet, we have three kinds of moduli. We have the complex structure, which roughly governs the deformations of the shape of the collabial. We have the dilaton, only one of those, and we have the Kähler moduli, which governs the sizes of the cycles of the collabial. Now, for today's purposes, by Kähler moduli, I just mean the overall volume. As you may know, there can be lots of other kinds of Kähler moduli corresponding to blowing up different cycles in the collabial. I'm only talking about this one because this is the overall volume one is quite easy to treat. And it's the overall volume that I'm always going to be referring to as V sub C Y, where I was arguing last time from a straightforward dimensional reduction that I did on the board, you can read off what the kinetic terms are for this and what the potential is for this field. So you can really sort of get your hands on this one, the Kähler moduli. Okay, so these are the fields that we have that we would like to stabilize. And if I turn on freeform fluxes G3, they give a potential to the complex structure and to the dilaton. But not for the Kähler moduli. And the mass scale for this is a flux-induced mass scale alpha prime over R cubed, where R to the sixth is defined to be the Calabi-Yau polynomial. Okay. And finally, I was arguing that following work of Gukov, Vatha, and Witten, the potential here, induced by these three-form fluxes, can be packaged in a superpotential given by this integral over the threefold, G wedge omega, where omega is the covariantly constant 3-0 form. And this is conventionally just called W0. Okay, that's one ingredient. And this part, this is really the flux compactification part of moduli stabilization. Now I'm getting into the next part, which was the new ingredient introduced by KKLP. And that is that non-perturbative effects, for example, coming from Gugino condensation. Okay, so this is the next thing is going to be a complicated phrase, so I'm just going to write it out. Gugino condensation in N equals 1. So expectation value lambda lambda means Gugino condensation. In an N equals 1 SU N super Yang-Mills theory on N V7 rings, that wrap a four cycle, sigma 4, in the Calabi-Yau. Okay, so these non-perturbative effects give a superpotential this form, where rho is r to the fourth plus the phase, and I remind you again, r to the sixth is just by definition the Calabi-Yau volume for today's purposes. Okay. Why is this non-perturbative effect interesting? Because these things that we've been able to think of so far, turning on freeform fluxes, which are fairly natural objects to include, manage to stabilize the complex structure of the dilaton, but not the overall volume. Now, the most serious of the problems about is the decompactification problem, because we're just going to try and turn on some positive energy and you run up to 10d flat space. So we really had better find a way to generate a potential for the Keller moduli, and this is the way that KKLP thought of. So the picture then, I had some Calabi-Yau. What I have to do is I have to put a stack of D7 brains on a four cycle. And I have to arrange that the gauge theory living on that stack undergoes Gugino condensation. The Gugino, as I mentioned before, the Gugino condensation aspect per se is not very important. You should just think you want to arrange an asymptotically free gauge theory on a stack of 7 rings. Okay, and that will depend on the volume. Okay, and one piece of possibly intuitive information here. Why does this depend on the volume? Because the gauge coupling on in the 4D gauge theory depends on the volume. So these non-perturbative effects are proportional to e to the minus 8 pi squared over g squared n. And so the reason that the superpotential affects the volume at all is that g here is associated with the volume. Any questions about this? You may think, why am I actually telling you the details of this rather than just saying that a solution exists? The reason is that actually to build any of these models that I'm going to be referring to later, and more specifically, to assess the problems in these models, you really actually have to have access to the real internal workings of the moduli stabilization mechanism. Okay, and that's, I think, an important point. It's not at all sufficient to say, well, some people figured out how to stabilize moduli. Now we can just forget about the moduli and build our inflation models. It unfortunately does not work out that way. It's really necessary to explicitly stabilize the moduli and pay attention to what you're doing, because that's going to affect the implicon potential. And I'm going to exhibit that later. Yes?
How do you determine the coefficients of that
potential? How do I determine little a or big a?
No, it's not zero, big a.
Big a? To know the big a, that is a very good question. That is a hard thing to determine. Big a being zero in the case, in this case here, is roughly equivalent to there being a it's equivalent to there being a vanishing amount of perturbative superpotential, which is something that could happen if, for example, this weren't an asymptotically free gauge. So in this construction with B7 brains, A is 0 if you haven't actually arranged that you have the right gauge contact. For example, suppose you arranged that you didn't have just a pure glue super Young mills, but you had some adjoint matter fields. Then you could indeed get a 0 coefficient there. The nice thing is that in flux backgrounds, those extra adjoint matter fields correspond to deformations of this four cycle. Okay, and the way you count such deformations is by H2 0 of given form. So you ask a topological question, and the answer you get is how many adjoint matter fields. The nice thing is that in flux backgrounds, this counts the number of adjoint matter fields you start with. But once you add the fluxes, the matter fields tend to get masked up. And so you can actually do an effective theory below that scale, where they're gone, this cycle becomes rigid, and A is definitely a construct. And in case anyone's interested, the computation of little a, this is just a question of the normalization of a gauge coupling on the set. Any more questions? Okay. Right, so the potential when we've included this effect looks like this. Here's rho, v of rho, as usual. As we know it had to, it asymptotes to 0 at an infinite volume. And here we have a supersymmetric ADS4 times the Laplacian solution. So that's very nice. Oh, without moduli, right? That was the whole point. This is not good enough. If we want to build something like a De Sitter space for present-day dark energy, or if we want to do something with inflation, we surely have to have a positive cosmological constant. So we need to be up here somewhere. So this is what's called uplifting. We want to find some kinds of ingredients that will uplift this. And now, your first thought might be, oh, I can think of lots of ways of breaking supersymmetry. Why don't I just add something that breaks supersymmetry? Then I lift up the CC. The problem with that is you can't do it too quickly, because if you break supersymmetry at the string scale, then everything falls apart. Let me remind you that we have some hierarchy of scales here. Below this scale, we have a compactification. Below this scale, it's a stable compactification. If we break supersymmetry at this scale, say by adding, let's say I just add a D3 bar, an anti-D3 brain. The tension of an anti-D3 brain is larger, in fact, for weak string coupling, it's much larger than M string to the fourth. So if you consider such an ingredient and try adding it, you're going to break supersymmetry so badly that you don't have any reasonable sense in which you're weakly breaking supersymmetry, and you will end up causing a runaway decompactification. The net potential when you've added that effect looks like this. Okay. So you should be suspicious whenever anyone tells you of a proposal for uplifting. You should ask, what's the systematic expansion that makes that a small amount of supersymmetry breaking? So, I mean, the proposals typically involve some kind of antibrain or some kind of flux, and you have to understand why is it that that flux is systematically small, or that brain tension is systematically small. So I'll show you how to do that. There's a fairly straightforward proposal for doing it. Any questions on why this has to be a small supersymmetry breaking? Okay, consider n D3 brains in 10-dimensional flat space. By 10-dimensional flat space, I mean the space is flat before you add the brains. Okay. The solution near the brains is this form. Here, omega 5 is angular volume, is the angular line element on the 5 sphere, and L is defined as like this. You will very often see this written in the literature as capital R, but I've already used that for the volume. Now, if you look at this part of the metric and omit the 5 sphere, you'll note that that's actually ABS 5. So I'm not doing anything particularly surprising here. I'm just saying that if you take a stack of NT3 brains, then the near horizon geometry is ABS 5 plus S 5, as familiar from the ABS and NT correspondence. So there's a crude picture associated with that, where you have the stack of brains here, and then some sort of growth of less and less warp space for us. Why do they introduce this stack of NT3 brains? Well, we know what the action for an anti-D3 brain is. I want to take an anti-D3 brain and add it to the stack. And the action is, here I'm just writing the Born-Infeld part. Experts will recall that there's a Chern-Simons part also, but we're not going to need to worry about that for the moment. And what I mean by G-induced is the metric of the ambient space pulled back to the brain, i.e. I use this usual formula for getting an induced metric, where C alpha and C beta are coordinates on the brain. And F and capital N run through all 10 coordinates. OK? Well, if I now set C0 is equal to X0 and Ci is equal to Xi, in other words, I just let the brain lie perfectly flat along the Minkowski directions, then I can easily compute this metric. And I get that G induced mu nu is eta mu nu times R over L squared. So the action, the potential for an anti-D3 brain that's sitting at rest in this background is equal to its tension times this integral over its world volume. I'm going to omit the root det g now, because the metric on its world volume is just eta mu nu. And I have an extra factor r over l to the fourth. And that's the key. That's what I was driving for. What that means is, if the brain the anti-brain happened to be sitting at some fixed value of r sub 0, then I could pull this out of the integral. I mean, this would have no effective dynamics, it's just some constant. And then I have an effective tension. T effective is equal to the usual tension times r over l. The fourth, i.e., the tension is warped down. Okay. Now, if you're familiar with warped scenarios, well, even if you're not, you may note that this has mass dimension 4, and this is 4 powers of the warp factor. So this is just like, this is warped down, this tension is warped down in the same way that any energy density put in this warp region would be. okay, what's this good for? Well, this is the solution to the problem I was just posing of how do you get a controllably small supersymmetric ring. Because now we imagine a picture like this. Here's the bulk part of the Calabi-Yau, and then here's some throat region sourced by N D3 brains.
Yeah.
Yes.
How do you make that configuration static?
You don't. I will do it in just a minute. You're absolutely right. If I imagine N, here it would be a complete lie, the fact that I left out the Trin-Simon term. But even without the Trin-Simon term, you can see that this is not static. In fact, what is it? It's a quartic potential in terms of R, drawing it towards zero, which is reasonable because this background is made by the D3 brains, and here I have an anti-D3 brain, so they have both a gravitational and a Ramond-Ramond attraction. So they're going to be pulled toward each other. These ones are sort of dissolved, sitting in place. This will be pulled down very rapidly. So it's not static. What one has to do is replace this crude picture with some geometry in which the D3 brains have all been dissolved, such that the anti-brain tries to run down to the end, where it's more and more warped. So this is the least warped region, and then here it's getting more and more warped. These lines just now are crude schematics for the amount of warping, not for actual brains. There are no D3 brains here. It's just all dissolved into background. When that's true, the D3 bar runs down this, you know, very rapidly to the bottom. It gets to the bottom, there's nothing there to annihilate against, and it just sits there.
What do you mean exactly by dissolved?
By dissolved, I mean that there are no open string degrees of freedom in this solution. There are no open string. If I didn't put this D3 bar here, ignoring this guy for the moment, down here, this is just a solution of supergravity with no open strings or with no D-brain sources. It's a background involving only geometry and flux. So let me say a little bit more about that, actually. So, I mean, in a sense, this is the whole point. How can we take this crude model of a cutoff ADS and replace it with something nice where the anti-brain can't just run down and annihilate it with the D3 brains? Any other questions about the setup unrelated to this one, which I'm now going to proceed to? Okay. So we want is something that we want a warped geometry and let's call it a throat. By a throat we just mean a warped region that's sort of one-dimensional in the sense that it warps along a single direction. We want a warped throat without any D-brains in it. Because in particular, if we have D3 brains in it, then the anti-brain can just annihilate against them. The way to do that Okay, so I'm going to dive into a few moments of this geometric construction, so I want to make it clear what we're trying to do. What I'm trying to do is present to you a geometry that's strongly warped, and in which an anti-brain has a very small tension, but in which the anti-brain cannot find any D3 brains against which it can annihilate. Okay. So yes.
You need all this construction of D-brains to stabilize your modeling. So can you, if what you're trying to do, so should be able to find this solution to stabilize all the modeling we store?
I don't quite understand. The brains that I needed to stabilize the moduli up there were D7 brains. Now, I didn't need to introduce any D3 brains or anti-D3 brains to stabilize the moduli. Okay, so that picture there, which is a caricature of a Calabi-Yau with D7 brains, is a proper representation of the configuration is this potential for the volume, which stabilizes all the moduli in anti-de Sitter space. Now I want to stabilize it in de Sitter space, so I need to find a way to add control of this null space breaking. Could you say the question again for a slightly different?
I thought you added the difference to stabilize.
No. There is no need for deep rates to stabilize the module. One thing you might be thinking of, perhaps, is that these D7 brains, they fill 0, 1, 2, 3, the space-time directions, and they wrap this 4-cycle sigma 4. So in a sense, they behave in four dimensions like D3 brains. But honest D3 brains, I didn't need to add any. Other questions? I don't want to leave anybody confused once I start moving into this. I don't want to leave anyone confused about the setup steps. Okay. Consider the following equation. In C4. The Z's, C4 parameterized by Z1 through Z4, or complex square. This is one complex equation. And we have four complex variables. So this is complex dimension 3, the solution set. In other words, it's a 6 manifold, a real 6 manifold. It has a name. It's called the conifold. It's one of the very simplest Calabi-Yau manifolds. It is Calabi-Yau. So here, there's a possible misconception. You may have heard some lore that nobody knows a metric on a Calabi-Yau space, etc. Can't write down an explicit Calabi-Yau construction. Well, that's for a compact Calabi-Yau space. This is non-compact. So it really is legitimately Calabi-Yau. There's a picture you can draw of it, which is a cone. You can convince yourself by staring at this equation that it has a sort of a scaling symmetry, make it behave like a cone, and it really is a cone over S2 times S3. Okay, that's topologically. In more detail, it's so topologically, that's what it is. And if you're happy with that, great. If you want to know a little bit more about the geometrical data, it's a cone over the coset space SU2 times SU2 mod U1, which is a fun. And because this is a coset space, then if you work hard enough, you can figure out the metric. And then I'm just telling you, the conifold with its Calabi-Yau metric is a cone over this coset space. This is the 5 manifold. So I'm going to do something to mess this up a little bit. Now I'll consider the equation sum of Zi squared equals epsilon squared for some constant epsilon. In other words, I'm just changing the right-hand side of the equation. And what that turns out to do is it takes this nice sharp cone and it smooths it out. Smooths it out such that at the tip, there is an S3. An unshrunken free sphere. So there's a way of drawing that picture there. By the way, sometimes, to be precise, people call this the singular conifold. Singular because it has this sharp point. So it's a cone over an S2 times an S3. And as you move along the radial direction here, this is radially inward, both the S3 and the S2 shrink. So here again is the singular conifold. and what I'm drawing here is the traditional cartoon of this other space, which is called the deformed conical. Now, what's different about this cartoon is you see that the S2 is still shrinking down as I move radially, but the S3 is not. So this is a picture that represents the fact that there's a finite S3 at the bottom. Okay? I don't know. In the interest of giving you a variety of approaches to this space, the deformed conical here, this guy here, the thing obeying that equation, is equal to the total space of the cotangent bundle of S3, which you can sort of imagine as being a free sphere with some sort of radial R3 fiber root. So this is the S3 at the tip. OK. So why do I get into this digression about conifolds? It turns out these conifolds are the easiest way to make a background that mocks up a slice of ADS. It's highly warped. It can lead to controllable supersymmetry breaking without the pathologies that an ADS itself would introduce. I'm not going to have time to present this, but there's a solution called the Klebanov-Strassler solution, also known as the warped deformed conifold. In which one takes this deformed conifold and introduces m units of the Ramon flux F3 at the tip and minus k units for some integers and k of the NSNS flux H3 along the radial direction, roughly speaking. So what am I talking about here? I take a geometry that I know, and the remaining data that I can specify is some integers, because I can tell you how many units of flux are turned on each available 3-cycle. So there's a 3-cycle here, conventionally called the A cycle, and there's a 3-cycle that's radially extended, which is conventionally called the B cycle. I'm just saying, turn on some amount of one flux on the A cycle, another amount of another flux on the B cycle, and what happens, magically, this whole space warps, and it looks like a piece of ADS, or quite close to it. Now, if you look in the famous paper by Klebanov and Strassler, you can see the explicit metric for the space, and it is smooth. But you don't really need that. For almost all purposes, you can really think of it as being like, so this warped deformed conifold is really analogous to this cut-off ADS picture, KS stands for the Klebanov-Strassler solution. It's analogous, except there's nothing left at the tip. There are no brains there. There are no open string excitations there. There's just flux. So this is potentially quite confusing. So there's some questions. Yes?
I mean, this is geometry, so it's in some sense like a classical picture.
That's correct.
So, and then if you're saying that the D3 brains are resolving into geometry,
yeah.
It seems like we have like the full string theory, and now you're taking some sort of low energy approximation, so you get a classical background part. I mean, I don't understand still why can you do that.
Okay, well, the dissolving the D3 brains is actually a heuristic. And it's not that what I do is I start with something and then I imagine dissolving brains. Although if you look in the series of papers by Klebanov, you'll see a very precise definition of what is meant by that. However, what I'm saying here is something quite different, which is, inspired by the idea of dissolving these brains, consider a geometry, the deformed conifold, okay, that one there, and just turn on flexes. That's it. So I'm turning on classical stuff and find the supergravity solution. Klebanov and Strassler found such a solution. And it's a classical supergravity solution with a systematic expansion. So in the limit that there's a lot of flux turned on, the curvatures of the space are small, the tip is big, the spaces are long, and there's no failure of the alpha prime expansion, say. And so everything is well described by classical supergravity.
So you don't have any D3 brains anymore?
I don't have any D3 brains anymore.
But you never had them in some sense.
That's correct. However, the thing which I have been sort of sneaking in here is that if you compute the integral of H3 wedge F3, that carries D3 brain charge. Okay, so what I've done is I've actually turned on the fluxes here. You see, since these fluxes are on dual cycles, the wedge product of these two fluxes will integrate to something non-zero. And in fact, in this background, we get m times k, which we can define to be nd3. In other words, this background, this Kolmogorov rational solution, has no open strings anywhere, but it carries m times k units of d3 brain charge, where k is this, and m is that. So that's the precise meaning of the there were d3 brains, but they're dissolved. Okay. I mean, it carries d3 charge. Okay. I have more questions about this.
So you're not dynamically moving from one set up to the other.
That's correct. I'm not imagining that I really start with the brains and dissolve them. I'm just beginning with the fluxes turned on.
So if you have this charge, so don't you have the net charge? And then
yeah. So the Kolmogorov rational solution is a non-compact solution, and that's why there's no tadpole worry for that. And what I've been suppressing systematically in these talks is the fact that really I'm thinking about some orientable. So what I need to do is picture, for my total scheme, I have some compact collabial with a hole cut into it, and I insert a Kolmogorov rational throat, which carries m times k units of d3 charge, and I need minus m times k units of d3 charge over there. Okay, and typically this is known to be something you can accomplish using, say, orientifolds or other kinds of things that are going to be fixed in place and won't come running down into the throat and spoil the picture. Okay? But yeah, that's an important point. Other questions about this? Yeah.
So if you were to do that, so again, the D3 bar still stays in its place, or again you have it annihilating the D3?
But D3, good. It doesn't annihilate. It runs down to the bottom and sits there. Because once it's down at the bottom, what does it see? It sees a supergravity, a smooth geometry, and it sees some flux. But that's it. It does not find. So, what I mean by annihilate, for those who haven't thought about this before, if I have a D3 and a D3 bar on top of each other, I can consider the open string that stretches between them. That mode is tachyonic when the separation of the brain and the antebrain is less than a string. Okay, and that tachyon can condense, and that's what gets rid of the D3 and the D3 bar, and replaces them with just a sort of nested web of D1 and D1 bars. It's dissolved away. Now, that's not possible if there's no such string. You know, if there's no D3, then there's no way for the antebrain to just annihilate with anything. So it's sitting down at the bottom all alone. The only open strings are open strings that start and end on the D3 bar. So there are no tachyons. Now, it's not true that I can make it sit here. It runs to the bottom. But then at the bottom, it stops. This is a smooth geometry that ends. Okay. More questions about this?
The space is non-compact. Why do you need to cancel the tripod?
The space itself is non-compact. So the Kolmogorov rational solution with no orientifolding is a satisfactory solution with no tadpole problem. But what I'm going to eventually do, I want to use this to engineer. I want to put the antebrain here so I have a weak amount of Susie breakage. And I want to do that in a compact model. So I'm imagining this as a module that I can glue into some compact construction to give me a weak supersymmetry break. So I'm effectively building some sort of tool that I can glue in to a suitable collabial. So I play whatever games I need to over here. You know, I have these N D7 brains here stabilizing the Taylor moduli, and then I glue this thing in to break through. Is that clear?
When you put the start non-compact and compact together, is it non-compact?
Oh, yeah. Well, what I mean by non-compact is I take a finite extent of a non-compact space. In other words, this is some cone. Let's just do it with just a plain cone. Then I run it up to some R max, and then I just cut. And then I glue. So this is now, well, depending on whether I take the closure of this or something, this is made, this is compact. Okay. More questions about this? Okay, so what has all of this accomplished? It has just allowed us to uplift this KKLT construction, in other words, to break supersymmetry in a controllable way. But the reason that I went through all the details is that these throats are fantastically useful in type 2D modeling. So let me just draw the picture for the KKLT potential and then say a little more about why these throats are generally useful. So this is what we had before for V of rho. And now when we've added this warped down antibrain, we end up there. And this is the famous metastable de Sitter vacuum. Now, what do I mean that these throats are more generally useful? Well, you can do a ton of things with them. One of them is that they're dual to a gauge theory via the ADS-CFT correspondence. So it gives you a certain amount of technical control. The other thing is that it allows you to set the scales very freely. This is something which is not possible in present knowledge of heterotic or type 2A chromatifications or M-theory chromatifications. So whether you're building cosmological models or particle physics models, one of the nicest things you'd want to be able to do is put things at scales where you want them. You know, change energy scales. And the way you can do that in these type 2B chromatifications is by putting in a throat of the desired length, the desired amount of work. Okay, so I think, you know, if you take a first look at this, if you haven't already seen it, take a first look at the literature on type 2B particle physics and cosmology model building, you might wonder why people are using throats so much. And it's because it's a useful tool for dialing scales, which is something that you do without thinking if you're doing QFT model building, because you just say where the scale is. But if I hand you a heterotic solution, you'll be hard-pressed to do the equivalent of this, to warp down an energy scale by a large factor. Okay, so that's really the reason that these things are so popular. Oh, there's one more reason that they're popular, which is, you probably do not recall that one of the conditions that I stated is important for getting a model you can really get your hands on of string inflation is having an explicit metric. Now, this is an explicit metric. So it's sort of, it gives us the capacity to ask concrete questions and then answer them. Whereas if we were working with just a collabial that looked like that, and I didn't have any almost non-compact and sort of asymptotically conical region, I would have no hope of writing down anything like a metric. Yes?
So is it correctly thinking of this as having some sort of collabial, and in some region of that collabial you'll have this what geometry? Because you have some flux term now?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Rather than thinking of just putting two stuff together.
Yeah, right. So the reason that I'm imagining gluing them together is that with present technology, people almost never start by writing down a compact collabial and then say, ah, look, it has these throats, et cetera. This has been done, as far as I know, only once in the original paper by Giddings, Scott, and Polchinski. They showed you could write down a fourfold that descends to a 2B construction with a KS throat. That's been done once. What people really do is they work with this region, and they say, well, let me make sure I can take care of a tadpole over here. Let me make sure there's no pathology over here. But we're always just hoping that nothing goes wrong in this fluid region. Yes.
So that's kind of interesting because, I mean, you introduced the throat in the first place because you had anti-leafy brains for explicit supersymmetry breaking and performing the tension too small, right?
Yeah.
But now, I mean, after KKT, there have been other methods of breaking supersymmetry that some people may like better, more natural. But now you're actually saying, well, the throat is actually something that is a virtue rather than.
Oh yes, I do not think of the throat as being a sort of an ugly way that KKLT solved the problem with the first tool they were able to pick up.
But what's the modern viewpoint? Would you say you'd rather break supersymmetry some other way and still introduce growths to do other things? Or
I think everyone is waiting for a better method of supersymmetry breaking.
But can you, I mean, I thought there was some, I mean, I know that D-term supersymmetry breaking has its own trouble and there's no explicit model. But isn't there something else that you can just have, I don't know, corrections to the credit potential that give you the same?
Right. So I'm not saying that there haven't been successful ideas since this proposal. Okay, I think what I'm saying is I think most people would agree what we're waiting for is something that's absolutely computable and controllable, where we see that the supersymmetry breaking scale is very small, and we don't have to perturbative corrections are slightly worrisome for the reason that you might expect. You know, you have to explain why these first few perturbative corrections are important, but the remaining ones aren't. At present, people still seem sort of by default to be using things like anti-brain Susie breaking, but my suspicion is that we'll come up with something much better.
Well, for example, you've got the large problem model.
Right. So in those cases, the supersymmetry breaking is inferred by an F term for the volume modulus, which for Yeah, no, that's a very nice way of breaking supersymmetry.
And also Eva.
Yeah, that is an in-principle method, which I think, I suspect most people would agree, the most natural thing you would expect is you just search the F-term potential and find some minima that are above zero. The whole problem is, computationally, that's very hard to do. So I believe that was only attempted once by Eva and by Alex Altman, and I think that's all that's happened. Okay, more questions about this? Okay. So what have we got here? We have construction. Yes.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I addressed this question because, for example, if you take this integral model or large volume model, then do you still need to have this kind of
have which kind of
thing? I mean, he's saying, supposing there are networks of breaking, apart from the traditional
interface. Then do you need a approach?
Yeah.
No, by no means. By no means. However, it's still. Okay, it can go two ways. Either you may think the most appealing thing in string phenomenology would be to have an extremely restrictive framework, where all the scales are dictated for you from the beginning. If you don't put in any throats, that works quite nicely, because you really can't set many of the scales. The alternative, these throats are sort of modules that allow you to dial scales. So even in the absence of worrying about Susie breaking, they have that property. So no, you don't need them, but you can still find them. More questions? Okay. Okay, I don't want to end up dragging you through a detailed version of brain inflation. So I'm just going to draw a picture and give you the basic idea of how it works, and then move on to the next topic, which is more interesting. Okay, here's the same picture again. We have these seven brains on this four cycle. We have a Klebanov stress with throat, fluid in some kind of compact Calabi-Yau, and I have an anti-brain at the tip. Okay, and this is a metastable de Sitter solution. So what we want is something, we want a potential that's explicit, flat, as defined by the conditions that eta is much less than 1 and epsilon. Is much less than 1. And in a stable vacuum. With this construction, what we have in hand, well, it's a stable vacuum. And we have an explicit metric, so that looks good. All we have to do is see, is there a flat potential in this construction? Okay? And then the proposal is consider a D3 brain in this background. As was commented before, there's nothing that's going to keep the D3 brain from moving toward an anti-D3 brain. So it'll feel some potential and move this way. Okay? And I'm going to claim, you can find this, in the following paper, that V is very flat. I'm going to put an asterisk because I'm going to qualify that statement later on. Okay. How do you compute this potential? Well, you know how the D3 brain corrects the background fields. So you just compute that correction and see how it affects the potential for the D3 bar. The idea here, then, is that the D3 falls down toward the D3 bar. The whole time that it's doing so, it's in a stable vacuum, and it's in a region where we know what the metric is. When it gets to the end, the D3 bar tachyon comes alive, and the brain anti-brain pair disappear. And that's how it, reheating occurs. So the potential ends up looking something like this. Here, phi represents the radial position of the D3 brain. Here's V of phi. And up until about this point here, where there's a break, the brain is moving inward. And then from here onward, it's actually tachyon condensing. So this model has been worked out in a lot of detail. And it seems that all of these pieces fit together up to this star that I'm going to come back to. Questions?
You want that process of the D3 going to the end, D3 to be slow.
Yes.
How are you going to achieve that?
That actually, what I'm inserting here, this claim, well, is let me write down the potential. Will you be happier if instead of claiming that it is flat, if I claim the potential takes a specific form, which is flat? Or do you want me to compute the potential?
Oh, whatever. I just want to understand.
Okay. The physical understanding is that this is a very small fraction of an antibrain, effectively, because it's warped down. Okay. It carries a lot less mass and charge. It carries a lot less mass, at least, than a regular antibrain. And so the interaction between this pair is quite weak.
It commands very carries less mass, just because it's warped.
Well, we know what it. We know how it acts as a source of 4D stress energy. Because I wrote that T, D3 bar, is R0 over L to the fourth times the usual D3 bar tension. So it really carries. If R0 is small compared to L, which is the statement of work, then it actually sources, it's a weaker source of the stress energy tensor in 4D than it would have been without the work.
So when they actually get together, you will loosen all your initial setup, or?
So, very good. So what I should really do here is have two D3 bars and one D3. Right. Because now the one pair annihilates and there's one left over.
Oh, but I thought that one was really small. So.
It is. They're both really small. I'm not understanding the question properly.
No, because you told me that you were going to achieve the fact that they were going to come together because the anti-D3 brain was fresh.
Yeah.
So I was thinking that it was less than that, the D3 was.
Oh, no, well, the D3 tension is also effectively warped. It doesn't cause, the D3 is supersymmetric in this background without the anti-D3, so it doesn't make much sense to ask how much stress energy it's versus it's just Susie. But if you were able to ask what's its tension, you would find its tension is warped down. So it's also a small fraction of a D3. And when they get together, it's a small fraction of a D3 bar pair. And then they annihilate away, and there's nothing left.
Right. And you're just saying that you're going to have two of those so that you still are in the sitter.
So that I still have one left to be in the sitter at the end. That's right. That's a fine detail. For the inflationary question itself, if you don't worry about late time effects, it would have been enough to just talk about one of these, but let's say two. But in answer to your actual question, which I misunderstood at first, this is also a fraction of the D3 brain. By fraction, don't understand, like when people say fractional brains, they usually mean by some finite group. No, I mean by some factor which is a real number here. Okay, very crudely speaking, it is a fraction of a brain. The D3 is a fraction of a D3 brain in the same way, because I can just remove, I mean, the calculation that the tension of the D3 bar is warped down would have worked for a D3 also. Okay. Yes?
Have they estimated if there's some sort of back reaction effect for it when the D3 is going towards the anti-D3 brain or something? There one on Stablack?
Yeah. Do you mean like a shockwave from the D3? Yeah. Yes, there is no such thing. That effect is small. There's a scenario called the DBI scenario in which the D3 is moving very, very quickly. In such a case, one has to worry about it and has been worried about it. But in this case, it's drifting down very slowly and there's no important shuffle. But that's important.
And how do you make sure that the D3 is not attracted by the inverse? It's just...
No, that is a long story that occupied me for the last that's what the star is. What the star here means is... Okay, V is very flat. What do I mean by V? I mean the Coulomb potential that you would compute if what you looked at was the throat and you said, well, I have a particle and an antiparticle in six dimensions. Let me compute the Coulomb potential and the gravitational potential and put them together and see what I get. The star means, well, wait a minute, maybe the interaction with the D7 brain is an important effect also.
So you
get
papers that you ignore.
Well... In that paper, we knew that the effect was present. I'm sort of building this up in steps. The first step is a naive step. The claim is that the potential before you include moduli stabilization effects is flat. So now I'm going to prove. I want to say enough about this to make this model clear. But what I'm doing is stating sort of the naive stage of the model. The reason I'm stating that is that almost all models pass through such a naive stage. And there's a sort of a problem which comes crashing down when you try and stabilize the model. And that's known as the eta problem. And that's what I want to spend most of the rest of the talk. And the eta problem, this star here means that, well, you thought things were working fine if you're just looking at the Coulomb potential. Once you include moduli stabilization effects, the potential, the flat potential you thought you had is ruined. But I want to talk about that problem sort of systematically.
So these questions also relate to what we said before for the affinity. So when you have just the anti-affinity brain, so why is that running down?
There it's guaranteed because this feels a tree level force from the F5 background. Because this throat carries a lot of D3 charge. A lot. The force that the D3 feels to this is actually a moduli stabilization effect. It is a compactification effect. Compactification means that there is a finite Planck mass. As a compactification effect, is a Planck-suppressed communication. This is a tree-level direct communication that holds the D3 bar. So if you start with the D3 and the D3 bar up here, what's going to happen is the D3 bar will get yanked down very quickly, then the D3 will float after it. That's what we pretend. Unfortunately, the D3 also feels a weak Planck-suppressed force. Okay?
So it's very naive, you can see that you are comparing gravitational momentum.
The reason I wouldn't do that is that in this background, the gravitational and electromagnetic forces have the same strength. But this is a gravitationally suppressed interaction. So it's not tree-level gravitometry. Okay. Do you want to see anything about this Coulomb potential, or shall I just say what the star means and why that's a problem for Shackle? Is the star? Okay. I want to explain the general. Okay. This is now a problem which has nothing specifically to do with this model I described, has nothing specifically to do with the KDLT construction, and is just completely general for string inflation. Okay. However, I'm just using this model as an illustration of it. Okay. It's called the eta problem. And I can't stress enough, I mean, in my opinion, this is the most important problem afflicting string model building today, and it's the one for which almost all the efforts in the subject are directed at overcoming it in one way or another. What is the problem? The problem is that the slow roll parameter eta, which I wrote there, eta derived from leading order dimensional reduction. Without moduli stabilization. Is almost never an accurate guide to the true eta. By true eta, I mean, you know, we start with some string theory configuration. I tell you I have some Gaudian geometry, some flexes, and some grain. In principle, if you work long enough, you can compute the potential to any desired accuracy. Now, what you'll first do is do some leading order dimensional reduction. So by leading order, what kind of approximations do I mean? I mean a large volume approximation, the approximation in which we don't keep any alpha prime over R squared corrections, the weak coupling approximation, in which G string is much less than 1. So these are the two canonical expansions of string theory. Also the non-compacted approximation, which is the approximation in which I just play around in this throat region and don't worry about this, the fact that I'm really going to cut it off and glue it into something compact. The probe approximation. The probe approximation, this relates to the question about a shockwave coming from the D3 brain. The probe approximation is the one in which I don't consider the back reaction of the D3 for the D3 bar. The one instanton approximation. You'll notice that there is only one non-perturbative term in my superpotential, and you might say, well, couldn't there be a whole series? E to the minus rho, e to the minus 2 rho, e to the minus 3 rho? Well, I took rho to be large and dropped all the higher ones. And then the final one, for example, you might say, well, look, if you're doing something in Yang-Mills theory, as I was with the gauge inner condensation effect, shouldn't I worry about threshold corrections to the gauge coupling? So by leading order dimensional reduction, I mean not doing any of these things. Sorry, I mean assuming all of these simplifications. Which is how we do everything, pretty much. We start with these, and then we systematically build back in small corrections. Now, OK, you might say, who cares? It's almost never accurate. That's not a big deal. The big deal is the sad story of how inflationary model building typically proceeds in string theory now is you find a way to make eta small in the leading order dimensional reduction. And then, when you include all of these effects, your mechanism falls apart. And eta is back to being order 1. Now, when eta is order 1, you don't get enough inflation. You get roughly 1 E-fold in order of magnitude. Okay, so inflation just doesn't work. So the question is, how can you possibly arrange the eta's? Okay, so the way I've said this so far, it's a little bit vague. I mean, I've tried to state what the problem is, but you know, how are you supposed to see that these things, any of these higher corrections, are going to spoil the nice setup that you start with in the leading order dimensional reduction. Well, in this model, it's the effect of the D7 brains. So as soon as you explicitly stabilize the moduli, you find you have to introduce them to D7 brains. And you find that the leading force on a D3 brain here, it feels a weak force toward the anti-brain. That's what you want. If you wanted a weak force, you got inflation. It feels a really strong force toward or from the D7 brains. That's the dominant force in the system. You could have gotten around it. The way you could have done that is by saying, let me pretend the moduli are all stabilized. Then you can really build a beautiful model that way. But unfortunately, no one has found a way of stabilizing the moduli that doesn't introduce problems of this sort. OK, this is probably quite confusing. So are there questions or comments about this?
Is this like the biggest problem or the only problem?
Depends on how good you want the models to be. If you want, this is a problem that means the models are not natural. Okay. Now Will was saying this. I quite agree with what Will said. He said, you know, any inflation model is going to have some degree of fine tuning. Something which is often said is, you know, my model of string inflation works with no fine-tuning. That statement is almost always wrong. And the Ada problem is just the statement that although you might be able to construct a string configuration that gives you a naturally flat potential at leading order dimensional reduction, almost always people are not able to do that in a more systematic moduli stabilized scenario. What that means is that people were sort of hoping to use string theory not just to get an inflationary model, but to get a natural one. As Will said, we don't really have on hand many natural models of inflation in field theory where you make natural assumptions and the potential is flat because you're trying to get it to do something special. You want these two parameters to be small. You want it to inflate for a long time. It doesn't automatically do that. Now, you might have hoped, oh, maybe string theory will just give that to us. It does. Leading order. Doesn't matter. Leading order is not good for anything. Leading order was just the first step. So at higher orders, more accuracy, string theory is giving back what you would have expected from field theory intuition. Namely, if you want something nice to happen, you have to pay a price to make it happen. So that's, you can judge whether you think that that's a big problem or not a big problem. Another way of sort of defining what the Ada problem is by saying there are sort of two ways to make Ada small. And the solutions are fine-tuning and a symmetry. And of course, you immediately say, well, great, let's use the symmetry. This is certainly the most clever way to go. The problem is, the Ada problem is incredibly robust. I'm going to illustrate that in just a minute. I'm going to skip over that. The Ada problem is very robust because it depends on gravitationally suppressed interactions. So the only way that you can use a symmetry argument, you have to use a symmetry to suppress all dimension 6 gravitationally suppressed interactions. Okay. Maybe on the face of it, it's not obvious to you that that's a hard thing to do. It turns out that you have to master each one of these things in detail in order to, in any explicit case, show that you don't have this problem. Now, so why did I state that there are these two ways around fine-tuning and symmetry? Well, if you're willing to say, oh, look, I'm just going to find a bunch of ingredients that give different contributions to the potential and cancel them delicately against each other to make the potential flat, fine. Yeah, you can do that. You still have to work hard to make sure you've computed the right terms in the potential. In this setup, it just amounts to sort of tweaking where the D7 braids are such that the D3 eventually feels a flat potential. That can be done. We did that this past year. Not perhaps particularly exciting that because it's not natural in the end. It's just something that you push hard enough and eventually you're able to tweak enough dials to make the thing work. What people are searching for, have been searching for years, is the symmetry argument that makes the inflaton potential natural to flat. And such things have not been readily found. In fact, yes?
I was just wondering, I mean, in a lot of models, it's kind of hard to stabilize all the moduli. Sometimes you can stabilize almost all the moduli, but there's maybe two left or one left or something. So that seems to be pretty generic. So these moduli that you can't stabilize typically have a flat potential, at least in the leading order. So if that's a generic feature, isn't it kind of primitive to say, well, maybe I expect that at least some fraction of these originally flat moduli will receive small corrections or something? So
that I think that's absolutely the right expectation for the system. But that was actually what was true here, too. So before I worried about this, the D3 brain was actually the only unstabilized model. The D3 brain had a flat potential at leading order because of the no-scale symmetry. Mm-hmm. At leading order. When you go beyond leading order, suddenly that was lifted too. And the problem is, so there's a sort of a schematic of this. What is this Ada problem all about? It's that, right, so since Ada is the curvature of the potential, the inflaton mass is 3h squared Ada. You can read that off from the Friedman equation. Then here is mass squared. We have some natural scale h. Around our Hubble scale during inflation. And what we want to do is put all the moduli up here and have the inflaton down there. Phi here and moduli up there. The reason is we want to have integrated out the moduli so that we can do inflation. But we want to have the inflaton light compared to Hubble because that's exactly the condition that eta is small. Because we want this splitting. That is a splitting which I'm claiming you can achieve at leading order. In fact, this is an ideal example of that. At leading order, before you include this back, this D7-brain back reaction effect, is really a violation of the probe approximation here. Before you do that, the D3 potential is totally flat. Then you introduce this Coulomb interaction, it's just lifted a little bit. So exactly as you say, you have some unfixed modulus, you lift it a little bit, looks great. Problem is, when you include all of this junk, this splitting that you found collapses, and phi always runs at least up to h, and sometimes it runs up to the moduli max.
I guess what I'm asking is this problem any different from the other problems we have for the last state?
Yeah. We're asking for more. Okay. We're asking for more here. Right. The reason is we're not just asking that everything should be in principle stabilized.
So it's more difficult, but really it's the same problem.
It's a more difficult task in the same game.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, arranging the potentials flat over a large range ends up being quite hard. Now, okay. So, I mean, you know, none of the exercises that I give are things you're actually obliged to consider doing, so I'll just give you another one anyway. The exercise is find a published model of string inflation. And I'll say, ideally, find one that claims that it has a naturally flat inflaton potential and no eta problem, and show that it has an eta problem. Now, I suggest you try it a couple of times, because there are some models out there where the authors have worried carefully enough they may have addressed it. So you could pick poorly once or twice. But I think if you try three models, it's almost impossible that you will be unable to do the problem. Okay, so the point is that the claims of naturalists in the literature are very, very much overblown. And this is not because, you know, this is not because people are just foolish. The problem is, in many cases, no one knows how to, or no one knew when those models were proposed, how to compute each of these things. And it's been a hard technical step to add each of these. You know, various people are computing alpha prime corrections, string loop corrections, trying to glue these non-compact spaces into compact spaces, understanding violations of the probe approximation, i.e. brain back reaction effects. These are typically hard calculations. And you're entitled, I suppose, to write down a model and say, well, look, I don't know how to calculate these things, but probably it's going to work. But I claim, every time you actually do compute those things, then the nice models fall apart.
Yes. So then it's your opinion that there's no successful model.
No. I was very careful to say that I think if you pick randomly three times in the literature, you will not find three models that don't have this problem. Now, that's not to say also that I'm asserting that there are exactly two models in the literature that don't have the problem. Just that you probably won't find three of them in a row. Okay, other questions? However, I would agree, the number of successful models in literature is vanishingly small, because it's really hard to be sure that you've computed all these pieces. And what I'm advocating is it's a belief inspired by checking a lot of models one after another, that it's just not sufficient to claim these effects will be unimportant. They have always turned out to be fatal. One has to compute them first and then show that they're not a problem, rather than just appeal to some hope that, oh, don't worry, they'll help us. That's what I'm trying to get across. Okay, in the last 10 minutes or so, I want to communicate a completely different point. Are there any other questions about the eta problem before I do that? Okay, a completely different point concerns the tensor signal. Now, you heard a lot from Joao and also a bit from Will about polarization and detecting primordial tensors, right? Gravity waves lead to B-mode polarization, and we can detect those. could detect means if, you know, they fund a series of billion dollar experiments and the backgrounds are not very large and the signal is very large. So, but this is a really exciting thing. The reason is that, as you heard in the previous talks, gravitational waves look back before decoupling, before Z of about 1100. You know, they don't certainly don't care about opacity of the plasma. So you can really get your earliest probe that way. That's one thing. And the other thing is it gives a direct measurement of the scale of inflation. Because P gravity waves is proportional to V over M Planck to the fourth. This is actually just on dimensional grounds. The only thing around is gravity. We're talking about fluctuation, so there's also H bar. So you make M Planck, and then there's just some energy scale during inflation. Okay? Now, something to note, an important figure to have in mind, actually, is that V, the 1/4, is equal to 3.6 times 10 to the 16 GeV times R over 0.01 to the 1/4. Now, R, I remind you, is the tensor to scalar ratio. Which is just the ratio of the two powers that you saw in Willstrom. Why is this relevant? Well, the future sensitivity is roughly R greater than or equal to 0.01. In other words, if R is smaller than 0.01, then even with arbitrarily optimistic assumptions, it's unlikely that we'll be able to measure. There are some people who say you can go maybe just a little bit lower, but we just don't know. I should note that all the plots that Drow was showing you, as is, I think, quite standard in discussions of polarization, assumed R that was really large, like 0.4, close to the current bound. When you scale R down by a factor of 100, then the polarization signal gets really big, quite small. Okay, why is this an important relation? Because it tells you that if you're ever going to see tensor growth, it's going to tell you that inflation occurred at that high scale, 10 to the 16 GeV. It's a direct probe at that scale. So that's one reason why these are, this would be a fairly exciting thing to do. So let me just do a short computation. In reduced Planck mass units, the formulas that you've seen in the previous lectures for the gravity wave power and the scalar power are as follows. Here, phi dot is the time derivative of the inflaton, as usual. Now, the observable quantity is the ratio of these two things, R. So we can just easily see that R is equal to, well, cancel some stuff out and make it 8 phi dot squared over h squared and Planck squared. Okay, but phi dot is equal to d phi dt, which is equal to d phi dn dn dt. And dn dt is h. So we get that R is equal to 8 d phi dn squared over m Planck squared. So this and then the result that's going to follow from it in a moment are result of David Leith from 1996. I'm going to move from this simple relation to something known as the Leith bound, which is actually a very important relation between possible observations and fundamental physics. Okay, well, it's quite straightforward to rearrange this and find the following. Okay, that's not much has happened. It tells you that the field range in finite units, the distance by which the field moves during inflation, is related to the integral of the tensor to scalar ratio. Now, this didn't depend on an assumption about the potential. Okay, I did not put that in. This is just a generic result. Right? And it turns out, so I'll spare you the details, you can figure out how, what is this integral? This is dn from 0 to, let's say, 60. I'm not going to worry about whether we have 60 or 40. You can figure out how does r change as a function of n. That's not particularly hard to do in slow roll, but let me just spare you the steps and say, in the end, what you find, you can rearrange everything in the following way. And this is the relation. Let me use a prop here. This is true up to a constant that's really, really close to 1. Okay, so what's going on? On the left-hand side, this is the measure of observability in future experiment of the tensors, which I've argued are an exceptionally important thing. I mean, there are observational cosmologists who say observing tensors is the holy grail of observational cosmology. Well, at least, you know, the next 20 years or something like that. This is really the focus. Now, so this is, only if the right-hand side is 1 or larger are we ever going to be able to measure this. And this is delta phi over m Planck, namely the field excursion in Planck mass units. And this is where the interface with really fundamental physics comes in, because this is actually a quantum gravity question. Does a potential over a field range that's large in Planck mass units make sense or not? So what exactly is the, why is there a quantum gravity question here, or why is there something you might worry about? I'm going to give you something which is a crude argument in field theory, and then I will tell you how you could do a more sophisticated thing in field in string theory. Suppose I write down a potential like 1/2 m squared phi squared plus lambda phi to the 4 plus this sum. What that represents is an infinite series of non-normalizable contributions to the potential, which if you're writing down, again, I emphasize it's sort of the crudest, stupidest way, if you're writing down a reasonable effective potential for an inflaton, this is what you would do. Problem, you might introduce other things too. The problem here is that, let's say we could take the case just to be even if you want to worry about why there's not a linear in the cubic term. But that's not important. Clearly, if phi is large compared to m Planck, then this series is terribly divergent. And it's not at all properly described by this stuff. So the worry is, in an effective field theory with the Planck cutoff, can you ever make sense of a large field range? Now you may say, Planck cutoff, why don't I take a bigger cutoff? But you can't do effective theory above the Planck scale unless you have a really good theory of quantum gravity. So we really can't do that yet. So we're sort of stuck with this. One might sort of worry about this. Now, there are a variety of arguments for and against this. I'm not going to drag you through those arguments. There's not time for that now. I'm just going to say, after years and years of it, nobody settled it. People just simply do not agree. Is this should I write down those terms or not? Should I allow myself to consider a field range which is very large in Planck units or not? Let me stress, although it looked a little bit different in Will's talk because he was using the unreduced Planck mass, if I were doing m squared phi squared, perhaps the most popular model of inflation, by the way, the one that sits most nicely in the W map contours, you need to be at around 15 m Planck when you start the game to get 15 equal, 15 reduced Planck mass. And one reason that people have arguments about this is people say, well, you should be using the unreduced Planck mass or a reduced Planck mass. And we just don't know. This is not, we can't figure out these factors of of square root of 8 pi by sort of thinking, well, what's the smartest way to couple QFT to GR in an effective description? I think the only way to answer these kinds of questions is to appeal to a theory of quantum gravity, ideally to more than one, and do the computation. Find, can you get a large field range or can you not? And if you find a large field range, can you get a flat potential over that range? Okay? So I'm not going to be able to show you this, but in most string models, including the brain-antibrain one in the throat that I showed you, you can do that computation. It's an easy computation. You find the range is always small. Okay, what that means is that most string models, I'm not asserting that this is going to be true of all string models, but most string models firmly predict an unobservably small tensor structure. There are people who work in QFT, very smart people who work in the QFT framework for inflation and don't try and include string information, who say, no, inflation generically predicts a large tensor signature. So we have this completely disjoint prediction depending on what the framework is. So I think this is a considerable opportunity for actually asking and answering a scientific question, which is, do we or do we not expect to see tensors in the future generation of polarization experiments? So let me say one last thing here to stave off some possible misconceptions. What you may sometimes hear is that people will say, well, let's consider the following equilibrium potentials. 1/2 m squared pi squared, lambda phi to the 4th, constant minus 1/2 m squared pi squared, plus ... They don't fill in the dots. And then they say, well, you can check case by case that in each of these, inflation only occurs if the field range is large. Why is that? Why did I say 15 m phi here? Because if I compute eta here, I get 2 times m phi over pi squared. So first misconception, you might think, oh, don't worry, I can just make m small. No, m does not enter the slow roll equation. It's just m flank over phi. So you need phi to be large for slow roll to occur. That's true in this model, it's true in this model, it's true in this model, and that's it. All the other potentials are true. Yes?
What's the current observational bound?
The current observational bound is r less than, depending on how you measure it, around 0.3. There's actually some degeneracy because in the R and S plane, if this is 1, it depends on what you know about NS. But you can say roughly. Okay, what's going on here? I'm saying, if you study monomial models, you might think that the slow roll conditions are only obeyed when the field ranges are large. That's not true. You can have models. I'm going to superimpose it on this one for a sense of scale. You can have models like the one I was just describing to you, like that, where the slow roll conditions are obeyed over a much smaller range. So-called small field model and a large field model. The thing which is, so the distinction is, it's simply not true that the slow roll conditions always require large field ranges. They only do in monomial models. But it is true that observable tensors always require large field ranges. So the question of understanding large field ranges in string theory is a question of can string theory accommodate a large tensor? Okay, so that's all I'm going to cover. Thanks.
Thank you, Mayor. Nice to talk to you.